Members, please take your seats. The Civil Justice Subcommittee will come to order. Julia, please call the roll.
Chair Robinson?
Here.
Vice Chair Snyder?
Here.
Ranking Member Arrington?
Here.
Representatives Beltran?
Here.
Black?
Here.
Campbell?
Here.
Daniels?
Here.
Gant?
Here.
Lopez?
Here.
Maggard?
Here.
Maney?
Here.
McFarland?
Here.
Michael?
Here.
Overdorf?
Yes, ma'am.
Rizzo?
Here.
Roth?
Here.
Saroy?
Here.
Smith?
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Julia. Before we begin, a few reminders. I ask everyone to please silence your electronic devices. Actually, last committee, I forgot to bring my phone, and it was a very freeing feeling. So, leave your phone in your office next time. It'll work out really well. Please ensure that you turn your microphone on when you are speaking and off when you are finished. If you intend to speak before the committee, I request that you fill out a public appearance card. And I've already made my first two mistakes as chair. Last time, I forgot to introduce our very own Lindsay Collins. Lindsay, wave to everyone. Forgot to introduce Lindsay, first mistake. And then I only mispronounced two members' names last time. Welcome back, Vice Chair Snyder. I think I got that right after 2 years. And welcome back, Representative Overdorf, my roommate that I mispronounced your last name. Apologize for that, Representative. So hopefully those are the only two mistakes as your chair I will make during the next few weeks, but who knows. As you noticed on our agenda, we have two items that we're going to have presentations on. I would never want to make the courts wait, but we have been asked by the court system for them to go second. So we're going to flip things around, and we're going to have our first presentation on sovereign immunity and the legislative claims bill process. Our very own Jordan Jones will be doing the presentation. Mr. Jones, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. Good morning. My name is Jordan Jones. I'm the policy chief for the Civil Justice Subcommittee. And for the next few minutes, I'm going to be talking to you about the legislative claim bill process and the process governed by sovereign immunity. And at the end, if we have time and the chair allows, I'll be happy to take questions. So first of all, why are we talking about sovereign immunity and claim bills? If you have served on the Civil Justice Subcommittee before, you'll know that sometimes the Civil Justice Subcommittee hears claim bills or relief acts. And these are different from ordinary bills in several ways. And we'll talk about that shortly. But all of this background that I'm going to be giving you about merry old England and all that kind of stuff has a very practical implication for claim bills that you may be asked to hear this session. So I'm going to start off with some history of sovereign immunity. So under the English common law, the king could not be sued in his own courts. So much of the common law that we have today in Florida and in the United States is based on the common law of England. Now, although the king could not be sued in his own courts as a matter of right, he could be petitioned for relief. So you couldn't go into the king's courts and say, make this right. But you could say, would you please make this right? So what does the King of England have to do with the United States? Well, according to the United States Supreme Court, Alden versus Maine, that's a case that was decided within the last 25 years. When the states ratified the United States Constitution, each state retained the sovereign immunity that it had retained before the Constitution was adopted. And that sovereign immunity meant that each state had a right to not be sued in federal courts or in their own courts. Okay, so in Alden versus Maine, the United States Supreme Court said, "We hold that the powers delegated to Congress under Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution do not include the power to subject non-consenting states to private suits for damages in state courts." Now, furthermore, the 11th Amendment to the United States Constitution says that the judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said that sovereign immunity itself derives not from the 11th Amendment, but from actually from the structure of the original U.S. Constitution. Okay, so what does that mean practically? Well, that means that for our purposes here, the state of Florida and its subdivisions, which includes counties, cities, municipalities, school boards, certain hospital districts, are immune from civil liability for injuries caused by negligence, except to the extent that the state of Florida chooses to waive the right. Okay, so that's the first thing about sovereign immunity. So what decision has Florida made to waive its own sovereign immunity? Well, Article 10, Section 13 of the Florida Constitution, which is a good place to start, the Constitution, says that provision may be made by general law for bringing suit against the state as to all liabilities now existing or hereafter originating. Okay, well, what that means is Florida retains its sovereign immunity, but the legislature is able to waive that sovereign immunity either in full or up to a certain point. Okay, so what has the legislature done? Section 768.28, Florida statutes, in that provision, Florida has partially waived its sovereign immunity, both with respect to the state and to the political subdivisions of the state. So the caps currently are $200,000 per person and $300,000 per incident. So that means that an injured person may sue the state or a subdivision of the state and obtain a judgment from a court for any amount, but recovery is limited to that $200,000 cap or $300,000 cap, as the case may be. The government, the local government or the state, cannot pay a claim beyond these limits unless authorized by a claim bill. Okay, so that's where the rubber meets the road, potentially for the Civil Justice Subcommittee. When a claim bill is filed, what that bill is asking this body to do, this legislative body to do, is to authorize the payment above, over and above those caps. Or there are other types of claim bills we'll talk about momentarily. So these caps, these $200,000 cap and $300,000 cap were last adjusted in 2010 when the legislature raised them from $100,000 and $200,000 to $200,000 and $300,000. Now, there's one important exception to this cap. In Section 768.28, subsection 5, Florida law says that the state or a locality may agree to pay a claim bill. They can actually enter into an agreement to pay a claim bill that is within its insurance limits, but that exceeds the statutory caps without the need for a claim bill. So, for instance, if a local government carries insurance and that insurance policy limit is $1 million, someone sues that local government, gets a judgment for the $1 million, the local government is allowed to agree to settle that claim up to the policy limit. Okay, so that is the waiver of sovereign immunity. And I'll just mention, in case you're interested, each state has authority to determine what its own caps are. And so various states have come down in very different places, ranging from, you know, in Virginia, there's a $100,000 cap, all the way up to some states that have completely waived sovereign immunity, like Arizona. And then there's everything in between, including Florida. But those are varied approaches, and each state retains the ability to do that for the state. Okay, so let's talk about the claim bill process. So now that we've got the history out of the way, practically speaking. So the first thing to remember is passage of a claim bill is considered to be an act of legislative grace. It's not something that happens as a matter of right. It's something that's a matter of grace. So a claim bill may authorize and direct payment above the caps, the $200,000 and $300,000 caps. So when the legislature passes a claim bill, what it's doing is it's both authorizing a local government or the state to make a payment, and it's requiring the payment. It's doing both of those at the same time. A court cannot force passage of a claim bill. That is within the province of the legislature. That's something that's interesting to remember, that's a little bit counterintuitive. Normally, when we talk about going to court and getting damages, we think about the courts. But in this case, in this very, very narrow situation, the legislature has the final say on whether to pass the claim bill. Now, that being said, a claim bill, there are a few ways that where a claim bill is like other bills that you'll see, and there are other ways that it's not. So a claim bill is like other bills in that it has to be filed by a member, usually in the House and the Senate. The bill can be referred to committees, subcommittees. It may be heard in the committee. Each chair of the committee has the discretion whether to put it on an agenda. It can then go to the floor. It can be amended. Amendments can be filed. And if it's passed by both chambers, it's sent to the governor for a signature, just like a normal bill. But a claim bill is different from a regular legislative bill in that, number one, under the rules, it does not count against your seven-bill limit. Number two, lobbyists are legally allowed to contract for a fee that is contingent on the passage of a claim bill, which is different from normal bills. And the other way that a claim bill is different is that with a claim bill, usually what you have when someone files a claim bill is a situation where facts are kind of in dispute. It's hard to know exactly what happened. You know, did that person really run the stop sign? Was that person really liable? Did the state really make a mistake? Did a local government make a mistake? And so in order to make findings of fact, so that the legislature could be more aware of what actually happened, where is the truth, the speaker oftentimes will appoint someone, usually a staff member, as a special master to conduct an evidentiary hearing to make independent findings of fact and recommendations regarding the bill. And all of that process happens usually before you would ever see the bill. And while a past jury award or a settlement between the parties is persuasive, it's not binding. So for this session, Speaker Renner has appointed three special masters to kind of divide the workload on the claim bills. One of the special masters is Caitlin Maughan. Another one is Sarah Matthews, and then I'm also one of the special masters for the claim bills. Okay, here is the House rule, 5.6 for the special master process. So House rule, if you take a look at 5.6C, this is something that sometimes you'll be asked to take a look at, or it may be important. 5.6C requires that the claimant, which is the person seeking the claim bill, must exhaust all court remedies and finish all the appeals before the House can consider the claim bill. So generally, the claimant needs to go through the normal process, get the court judgment, get the settlement or whatnot, and then come to the legislature and say, hey, now it's ready for you all to decide on the claim bill. The special master generally has to avoid ex parte communications with the parties and their representatives in claim bills, meaning that you know, the special master can't go and have private conversations with claimants or whatnot, because usually those types of things need to come out in the special master hearing in the presence of all the parties. But those, you should just know that those restrictions, of course, do not apply to you as members. You know, you're welcome to meet with the claimant, meet with the lobbyists, meet with the parties, just like any other bill. There is also a 25% statutory cap on attorney fees payable from a claim bill. Historically, the legislature has required the lobbying fee to be paid from the attorney fee, so that the injured party can have a higher amount of recovery. Okay, so I'm going to go through a couple of three different claim bill examples. There are three kind of buckets that claim bills fall into. The first bucket is kind of what I've already gone over, which is a claim bill that is asking for money in excess of the sovereign immunity caps. That may be based on a jury verdict or a settlement. So I'll give you kind of an example for this, and I think the example works. So Suppose we have an unfortunate gentleman named, you know, Pete the pedestrian, all right? And Pete the pedestrian is walking, you know, downtown in a crosswalk with the walk sign, okay? He has the right-of-way. And a private truck, private company truck, hits him and injures him. Now, Pete is going to go into court and basically say, hey, this corporate truck right here hit me. You know, my damages, here are my medical bills. I'm out $1 million because I had to, you know, have all of these surgeries. I have pain and suffering. I have all these other things. And in that situation, the corporation who's the defendant may say, okay, well, we'll settle with you, you know, to avoid trial, to avoid all of these expenses. We'll write you a check for $1 million. That may happen. Or the corporation may say, well, you know, we think Pete was, you know, intoxicated. We don't think it was really our fault. And they may take the case to trial. And if the case goes to trial, the jury may award, you know, a verdict. So suppose the jury awards a verdict for $1 million. Either way, the corporation settles for $1 million or Pete takes the case to trial, gets $1 million verdict. Either way, the next thing that's going to happen is that corporation is going to write a check for $1 million made out to Pete the pedestrian, and Pete is going to pay his attorneys. He's going to pay his medical bills. He's going to use the money to do whatever he wants to do with, and that's going to kind of be the end of it. But if you change the hypothetical, and if Pete, instead of getting hit by a corporate truck, if he gets hit by a truck that's driven, that's owned by the state of Florida, state agency, state law enforcement, anything like that, what's going to happen is Pete is going to still probably file a lawsuit, go to court, and the state or the state agency or the subdivision may choose to settle with him for $1 million. They may say, hey, we'll settle with you for $1 million. Or he may take the case to trial and get a $1 million verdict, just like in the other case. But once he gets that judgment, once the court enters the judgment for $1 million, it's, you know, what happens to Pete is going to look a little different. The state agency or subdivision is going to cut him a check for $200,000, okay, which is that cap. That's that limit. And he's going to get that $200,000, and that's his, okay? And then if he wants the remaining $800,000, he's going to have to file a claim bill with the legislature. Okay, he's going to have to get a member to run the bill and file the claim bill. And then he's going to go through the special master process and all of the other things that I've been talking about. And then potentially that bill may come before you eventually, and you may have to vote on whether to give him that remaining $800,000 or not. Okay, so that's kind of the difference. So that's the first. Everything I just said is under the first bullet point. That's if you have a jury verdict or a settlement in excess of the caps. The second type of claim bill is one for wrongful incarceration. Now, this happens when, typically, it happens when someone has gone to prison for a crime that person did not commit. And then that person gets out of prison. The court, usually what happens is the court vacates the conviction, and the person says, I want compensation for the time that I was wrongfully in prison. Now, the legislature has already created a process so that people who are wrongfully incarcerated can receive relief, and that is in Chapter 961 of the Florida statutes. And Chapter 961 provides an administrative procedure for someone who is wrongfully incarcerated to go before an administrative law judge and basically prove, I was wrongfully incarcerated. Look, I've got the evidence. Now, you know, pay me the money that I deserve. And many wrongful incarceration cases get resolved through that administrative process, and you'll never see them, okay, up here. But there are some times when someone might be ineligible for that administrative process under Chapter 961. There are a couple of ways that can happen. One way that can happen is sometimes a person who was wrongfully incarcerated, that person's attorney may miss a filing deadline or somehow miss out on that administrative process. I've seen that happen before. Another thing that can happen is Chapter 961 has a clean hands provision. It has been amended over the years and relaxed, but there is still a provision that says if you've committed other certain types of crimes or a certain number of crimes, you're ineligible under 961. And so if for whatever reason, a person who was wrongfully incarcerated is ineligible for Chapter 961, that person can file a claim bill. And so you may see a claim bill that is relief of blank for a certain amount of time, you know, spent in prison wrongfully. And typically, when individuals come before the legislature wrongfully incarcerated for a claim bill, they ask for the same amount of money that they would have been entitled for entitled to under Chapter 961. That's the second type. The third type is basically everything else, claims that I call equitable claims that are not based on a jury verdict. Oftentimes, a court hasn't weighed in yet. And in these types of claims, it's important to ask the question, you know, for you all, has the claimant exhausted all of the appropriate remedies? So remember, we talked about House Rule 5.6C says the claimant has to go, you know, basically exhaust everything else, do everything else you can possibly do. Once you're done and you're out of luck, then you can come to the legislature and ask for a claim bill. Okay, so that's kind of a run-through of the claim bill process. All right, I've got some data for you. So if you care about data or you're a nerd like me, trying to make it fun here, but okay, so we've got a colorful bar chart here. So these are the claim bills filed, heard, and passed over the past 8 years. So the red bar is the number of claim bills that was filed. Blue is those that were heard, like actually at least put on one committee or subcommittee of reference. And then the gray is the number that was passed. That varies year by year for various reasons. Okay, so here's a pie chart that kind of gives you a breakdown of the typical amount of money that claimants receive through claim bills. So this pie chart represents the claim bills that actually passed over the past 8 years. And as you can see that over the past few sessions, exactly half of the claim bills that have been paid by the legislature have been for $1 million or less. So that's kind of one category. And then there's an intermediate amount, the blue, between $1 and $4 million. And then 11% were for $4 million or more. Okay, there's a distinction that I want to make quickly so that you can better understand this chart. So this is claim bills passed, state or local. So what this represents is the distinction between two types of claim bills, a state claim bill or a local claim bill. So a state claim bill, which is called a general claim bill, is one where if the legislature passes the claim bill, the revenue is going to be coming from the state government. Okay, it's going to come, it's going to probably need an appropriation. It'll come from general revenue, come from a state trust fund. So examples of these include a claim bill for wrongful incarceration or a claim bill against a state agency, Department of Transportation, Department of Revenue, you know, whatever. Okay, a local claim bill is one whose revenues will come from that local entity's funds. All right, so that's an important distinction. When the legislature passes a local claim bill, what it's doing is it's telling the local government, pay this claim, you pay this claim. And normally that comes from the local government's funds. So examples of those include a claim bill filed against a city, a county, a hospital district, school board. There are various types, but that's kind of the distinction. So roughly three quarters of the claim bills passed in the past 8 years were local claim bills, and roughly one fourth were against the state. Okay, another different two types of claim bills, different category, contested or settled. So a settled claim bill is one where the parties to the claim have entered into a formal agreement, all right? So the government and the claimant have something in writing that says, this is what we're going to pay. This is what I'm going to receive. A contested claim bill is one where the respondent, which would be the government, contests passage of the claim bill and is asking the legislature to not award the money, okay? Now, whether something is settled or contested is really more of a spectrum than a binary either or. But in general, On the one hand, you have claim bills that are contested, and the respondent is saying, please don't pay this. We think this is meritless, or we think that we don't have enough money to pay it, or there can be all kinds of reasons. And then over here, you have something that's settled, maybe even something that is supported, maybe even a claim bill that is supported, where the local government is saying, please allow us to pay this claim. We want to pay the claim. We think we were in the wrong, or we think we, you know, we want to pay the claim. Okay, these are just the average percentages awarded to attorneys and lobbyists over the past 3 years. You'll remember I said the statutory cap on attorneys' fees is 25%, but attorney fees have on the average actually been less than what is allowed. So attorney fees, 19.1% of the average claim bill goes to attorneys, 4.7% go to lobbying fees. So there's a statutory cap on the percentage of attorney fees, but of course there's nothing to prohibit an attorney from asking for less than the cap, or for taking the case pro bono. We've actually seen that sometimes where the case is, all the money goes to the claimant. Okay, that's it. That's my contact information right there. You can get in touch with me. I'm right across the hallway. If you need anything, I'm the policy chief for civil justice, and I'll leave it to the chair to decide if you want to have time for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. And one of the reasons I wanted to have a presentation on this, you saw the chart, the last 8 years, at least one claims bill has been heard, and it's primarily the exclusive jurisdiction of the subcommittee to hear claims bills. So it's a unique process to this committee that most likely, given the last 8 years, something's been heard that we may indeed hear in front of the subcommittee. This is our first time to have questions. I want to spend as much time as you all need with the policy expert. Actually, Mr. Jones was a master as well. Weren't you a special master for these cases as well as late as last year? And just as a reminder for questions, and I'll do this for all of our committee meetings, all the questions go through the chair. And normally what I do is allow three questions at a time, but all three through the chair, just to spread it out a little bit. And remember, per our rules, all questions are to elicit information. I think one of the more famous quotes last year that came from my very good friend, Representative Saroy, is this is a state house, not a courthouse. So remember that when you're asking your questions. And let me give you a little tip. If your question starts off, isn't it true, blank, 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 that's probably not a question. That's eliciting information. You're cross-examining someone, so let's stick to kind of regular questions from here on out. And with that, I think Representative Maggard, you have a question. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Great presentation. Thank you for that. Two questions I have, and I'll start with the first one. The chair so indulges. When would we look at a local bill, like a city bill? Because you said there's a time when we would tell that city to pay for something, right? So if the city of Leon utility truck causes an accident and they go through the process, does that come to us?
Ms. Jones, you recognize.
Okay, so Rep. Maggard, yes, it could. So the way that the process would work is if a Leon County entity injured an individual, that individual would first go through the normal court process and try to get the case settled or get a jury verdict. After that jury verdict or settlement is in hand, that person would theoretically approach a member of the House and say, I have a claim bill that I need you to file for me. And so the member would be the sponsor for that claim bill. Then at that point, it would kind of go through the process like a normal bill. It would be filed. You would see it. It would be your House bill, you know, odd number. Or it would be a Senate bill, even number. And then at that point, it would go through the referral process. So it would be referred to a number of subcommittees or committees. So a couple of those bills have already been referred. But then it would be incumbent on the member to go to the chair of that committee and say, please put this on an agenda. If it is placed on an agenda, Then what you'll see is the special master who was assigned to that claim bill will produce a special master report that will have the facts and everything that kind of happened in that case. And at that point in time, if it came before subcommittee that you're on, then you would be able to vote on the bill. Does that answer your question?
Representative Maggard, do you have a follow-up?
Somewhat. Thank you, Chair. I have one more question.
You're recognized.
We will come by and see you.
Okay, after sure. This.
The other question, can you give me an example why we would pay a lobbyist a fee for any of this?
Ms. Jones, you're recognized.
So that is wholly within the discretion of the legislature. So what we have done, as a matter of drafting over the past few years, is if there is a lobbyist on a case, on a claim bill, typically when you see a claim bill, you'll see a part at the end that says what the lobbyist fees are, what the amount is, or what the percentage is capped at. And those bills are subject to being amended, in any subcommittee or committee. So that question, lies wholly in your, area to determine as a subcommittee or as a committee, do you want to amend the bill and say there's going to be no fees or there are going to be fees? Typically, there's an existing agreement already between the claimant and the attorney and the lobbyist before the claim bill gets filed. But at the end of the day, the legislature has full, pretty much the authority to decide how much to spend on that.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Black, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jones, you may have covered this, but in case I missed it, quick question. Do special taxing districts enjoy sovereign immunity?
You're recognized, Mr. Jones.
That's a great question, Representative Black. I'm not sure. I think the answer is probably yes, but let me take a look at that, and I will get back with you. Typically, part of the reason I don't fully know is because typically the claim bills that we see here are ones where a local government has done something negligent and actually injured someone physically. And so I have never seen a claim bill against a taxing district, but I think that's probably because they typically don't have a lot of cars on the road, if that makes sense. But I will get back with you on that.
Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Jones, for your presentation. It was very enlightening. I know, I'm a freshman, so special session was enlightening as well. And we looked at how other states dealt with property insurance. So on this matter, I wanted to know, how does Florida compare with the other states who have sovereign immunity and what their limits are?
Ms. Jones, you recognize.
Yeah, that's a good question, Representative. So the states are really all over the place on that. There are a good number of states that have completely waived all sovereign immunity. And in those states, suing the state or a local entity that's a governmental entity is basically the same type of thing suing a person. Most of those states, though, don't allow punitive damages against the government, but in all other respects, it's the same. And then there are quite a few states that have limits on sovereign immunity. The lowest cap that I've seen is in Virginia, which is $100,000 cap. And then there are some states that run up into the multi-millions of dollars in caps. I don't know what those states do in terms of how those legislatures decide whether to pay above the caps, but that's kind of the framework of the landscape.
Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 8 of your presentation about the claims bills that have passed, do you know the breakdown of the types of cases that were passed? Because I know you gave us the 3 examples of the different types of claim bills that can be introduced. So do you know what that looks like in that?
Ms. Jones, you're recognized.
Rep, I do not have a chart for that, but I can tell you that generally the vast majority of those fall into the first category, which is the excess judgment. There is one over the past 8 years that is wrongful incarceration, and then I don't know of any that have fallen into the equitable category.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And I think I know the answer to the question based on your brief, but just to clarify, because this is my first time on this committee, if Pete the pedestrian is hit by a city of Tallahassee vehicle, and city of Tallahassee has $1 million liability, they can pay that $1 million and settle and never have to come to a claim bill without, they don't need to come to the legislature, up to their insurance limit. Any municipality or county can pay that claim up to their insurance without ever seeking redress through this committee.
Ms. Jones, you're recognized.
Rep. Smith, yes, that's correct. If the locality has insurance and agrees to it, that's correct. Yeah. And you'll never see it.
Representative Campbell, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Jones, for that lovely presentation. I could tell right away we're going to be best friends. And you say your office is right across the hall? Awesome. My question is in reference to one of your PowerPoints. I see over 8 years there's been a decline in filed claims. What would you associate to the factors that play into that decline in the filed claims that we're seeing?
Ms. Jones, you recognize.
Rep. Campbell, I would say it's hard to say. Each year there are a different number of claims. Part of that is based on how many accidents are happening. Part of it has to do with cases having to make their way through the court. During COVID, courts were closed. And so if someone doesn't get their judgment or if it's delayed, that kind of pushes the process back. But I think there are a lot of different factors that go into that, and I don't know them all.
You're recognized, Representative Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just final question. I'm looking at the attorney fees and the percentage. Does that include both sides of your the attorney for the government or attorney for the patent, plaintiff in the suit?
Ms. Jones, you're recognized.
That's a good question, Rep. Campbell. That is only the attorney fee figure is only for the claimant. So that is the percentage that is paid out of the amount the legislature is awarding only for the claimant's attorney. Typically the defense attorneys would be paid separately, not as a part of the claim bill process.
Representative Campbell, you recognize.
Is there a way that we can get data on how much, what that fee percentage for those working for the government, is it possible that we can get that type of data or that percentage at least?
Mr. Jones, you recognize if you can answer that. I mean, those are government attorneys. Actually, I represent governments. That's public information, but I don't know if we would have that data because they would bill their clients separately. But I'll let Mr. Jones answer that if you have any further information.
Yeah. Thank you. I don't have much to add to that. I don't ever see that as part of the special master process, if that answers your question.
Representative Roth, you're up next. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome.
On the waiver limits, say, for example, you may have 20 claimants, or maybe you might have a class action lawsuit. How does that change? Does that change the number? If you have 20 claimants, is it like $4 million plus $300,000? Can you explain that, please?
Ms. Jones, you recognize.
Rep. Roth, that's a good question. So if there were, God forbid, 20 people injured in one accident, sometimes that happens, the limit would be $300,000 total. So what would happen is the first person able to kind of get to the courthouse would get as much as they could out of the 300, and then whoever was left would need to come to the legislature to get paid at all if it's beyond the 300,000, if that makes sense.
Representative Roth, you recognize.
So I'm asking a silly question maybe, but so a class action lawsuit has a whole multitude of people. Does that give the legislature any problem? You have a class action lawsuit, and now you're having a local claims bill. Does that cause any problems?
Mr. Jones, you recognize.
Well, Representative, you may have stumped me. I'm not certain that class action lawsuits can be filed against the government, but I'm going to have to check on that. But I think getting to, I think what the root of your question, I think, is what if you have a just a tremendously enormous amount of people that are trying to recover? And in that case, the limit would be $300,000, and then the legislature would kind of have to craft the remedy beyond that. Whether it would be allowing each person to come up here individually and seek a claim bill, you know, for each piece of damages, or if the legislature would just want to make an appropriation and do it that way. That answers your question.
Great. Ranking Member Arrington, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Jordan. Thank you for the presentation. This is my first time serving on this committee, too, so I do appreciate the presentation. My question is on slide number 10, when we're talking about the claims bills passed over the last 8 years and those that were settled. Since we're just seeing the 8 years, I've seen before in my short time, like a claims bill be filed like 2 years in a row. Do you know on average for these that have been settled, how many years or how many sessions it takes for them to be settled?
Ms. Jones, you recognize.
Rep. Arrington, that's a good question. I don't have data on that. I have seen some, in my time here, I have seen some claim bills be filed and passed in the same year. I have seen others that have been filed 3, 4, 5 years and have not been agended, gotten through various committees, and then eventually they do pass. They're kind of like normal bills in that sense. You know, sometimes a bill takes several sessions before it actually gets across the finish line. But I don't know the average number of years.
Ranking Member Arrington, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it something I can maybe talk to you later about and maybe dive a little bit deeper on? And then explaining the process then, so if they have to file it multiple years, they have to come up here each year and kind of present their case, the victims and their families, each year before settling?
Ms. Jones, you recognize.
Rep. Arrington, generally, no. So how we typically do the process with the special master process is the first year that the claim bill is filed, we have the parties come up here and we hold a hearing. We have witnesses. We have deposition testimony, all of that stuff. And then if the claim bill is refiled, if it fails and it's refiled the next year, typically we just send correspondence to the parties and say, hey, we're going to kind of rest on the proceedings that we did last year unless something materially has changed. And so if the parties then say, you know what, nothing's changed, it's just 1 year later, then we don't go through that process again. It's very rare that we would go through that process more than once.
Thank you.
Representative Overdorf, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. So it seems, from what your answers to Representative Smith's question was, is that really the insurance company is, and their limits are really setting what you can get a settlement for without going through the sovereign immunity claim. It appears that if you have $1 million, you can go and get $1 million regardless of if there's a claim or there's a cap at the $200,000 or $300,000. Is that correct?
Mr. Jones, you recognize.
Rep. Overdorf, it would be, yes, I'd say, but that would be, it's within, the way I would say it is, under 768.28, it is within a local government's discretion to insure itself if it wants. And if it does insure itself, then that policy limit is the highest amount that local government could settle for without having it be a claim bill.
Overdorf, you're recognized.
As a special master, in your experience, have you seen any claims coming in between, say, $300,000 and $1 million?
Ms. Jones, you're recognized.
Yes, I'd say that is probably 20% to 25%, of the claims.
Thank you.
Representative Daniels, you're up next. You're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just had to say I happen to be the person that passed that one bill in over the last 8 years for a claim and I'm very interested in the wrongful incarceration. That's the type of bill it was. And I'm getting to my question, and I heard someone ask about lobbyists. when we did a bill like this, it took a team, and it takes compassion for a bill like this. It's just more than a bill, it's somebody's life. So we had a great team, and we worked really hard, and we got that bill passed. But my question is, I'm ashamed that I didn't even know that this bill was passed, and there's so few bills passed like this. So are there just not a lot of claims for wrongful incarceration, or is there a bunch of wrongful incarceration bills sitting up somewhere that didn't get through? Because this one bill, I did it on the House side, Senator Gibson did it on the Senate side, and, you know, although I'm not a freshman, really, I didn't know that it was so hard to get these bills through, and I just want to ask, you know, about the process, and maybe we could talk about it later. Is there a lot of these type of bills waiting somewhere, or, you know, I know how this bill got through because we work hard, but is there a batch of bills somewhere that's waiting for wrongful incarceration? Because I think there's probably a lot of people, not a lot, but there's more than we see that are deemed wrongfully incarcerated.
You got that, Mr. Jones? You're recognized.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. So, Rep. Daniels, I would say that the number of wrongful incarceration claim bills that are filed is a small piece of the total batch. I think what happens is most of the wrongful incarceration claims go through the Chapter 961 process, and so we never see them. The claim bill that you carried, Mr. Clifford Williams, that was one where that was one from the 60s, and the old clean hands provision, the yes. old law was on the books still, and so that was a really interesting situation because the clean hands provision has been amended now, so that would not be a claim bill today if that happened today, because the clean hands provision has been amended. So that was unique. But I think most of them get handled through the normal process, and it's only the very exceptional ones that come as claim bills.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Representative McFarland, you're recognized.
Representative Ovendorf, Overdorf answered my questions. I'm good, thank you.
I think I've gotten through everyone that one the first time around. Anyone else? Representative Gann, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to ask an extension question to Representative Overdorf. Is that correct? Okay, great. To his question about insurance companies. So a local entity can insure with an insurance company. Do insurance companies include provisions? Because it's a contractual issue, but do they include provisions that require claim bills to be filed in order to go over the statutory limit?
Ms. Jones, you recognize if you're able to answer that question.
So, Rep. Gant, I would say that those provisions are a matter of contractual law, and they vary. And I've seen different things. What Florida law allows is that if there is an insurance contract and the local government agrees to pay the claim bill, then that claim bill is allowed to be paid. The law does not say whether the insurance company has to pay it or what the contract has to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Actually, I actually have a question, Mr. Jones. We talked about this. So with the sovereign immunity caps, and let's say there's a claim over the insurance that the, let's say, a city has, why would that local jurisdiction even agree to an amount over, if they're immune, over a certain amount, why would they even agree to settle a case over the statutory immunity cap? And you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I think the reasons probably run the gamut. One reason that some local entities give in our special master proceedings when we ask them that question is that they want to spare the time and expense of a trial. They want to go ahead and settle the case. Sometimes the local entity genuinely wants to pay the claim bill and wants to get it done, get it up here, support it, pass it. But there are a lot of different reasons for that.
Great. Further questions on this issue? Ranking Member Arrington, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. Our caps currently are the 200 and 300,000, and I guess we started at 50,000 and 100,000 back in 73. Do you have any idea or looked at any formulas, like what's the adjusted medical cost since 2010, or how that inflation works with those numbers, what would be a fair price?
Ms. Jones, you're recognized.
Rep. Arrington, I would not be able to comment on what a fair price would be, since that's, you know, within the discretion of the legislature. But I would say that I think with inflation, 200,000 in 2010 is about like 270 today, 270,000.
Great. See no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Jones. Great presentation. Appreciate that. So we'll move on to our second portion of our agenda. I will now introduce Allie Sackett, a state courts administrator who will be giving a presentation on the Florida court system. Ms. Sackett, when you are ready, you're recognized.
Good morning, Chair Robinson and Vice Chair Snyder, Ranking Member Arrington, and members of the committee. My name is Allie Sackett, and I'm State Courts Administrator. I thank you for having me today and letting me tell you a little bit more about the overview of the court system. And I will say this is a high-level overview. If we have time, we will have options of questions, and if you have those, please feel free to ask me. So we'll just jump right in. Like any good organization, we have a mission statement, and the mission statement is that the judicial branch is to protect the rights and liberties, uphold and interpret the law, and provide a peaceful resolution of disputes. We want no dueling and no dukes being thrown, so we want a peaceful resolution. Of course, we also have a vision statement, and of course that we would like to see, and we hope that the citizens of Florida believe, that the judiciary is accessible, fair, effective, responsive, and accountable. So what does that look like in the state of Florida? So the Florida judiciary is just over 1,000 judges in the state with just under 3,500 FTE in support. You may be thinking that's a lot of judges, and it is. But what I think is very important to note here as well is that in the state of Florida, we have 4.9 judges per 100,000 people. We're very much below the average of 7.1, and then in comparison to other states, we're still well below the average at 4.9. It makes for a pretty lean judiciary. So diving in, what does that look like? Again, we're going high level, and we're gonna start with our county courts. So of course, there's 67 counties in the state of Florida. It is mandated that every county have at least one county court judge, but you'll see there's 335 county court judges, so clearly more counties have more than one judge. What do they hear? They hear traffic offenses, misdemeanor criminals, disputes up to 50,000, which is an increase effective January 1 of this year, and then landlord-tenant cases. We've also seen what goes on in our circuit courts. Again, 20 circuit courts. Those counties make up those circuits, so they're divided into 20. We have 606 judges in the circuit courts. And what do they hear? We also have a chief judge in each circuit and a trial court administrator that helps run the court. They hear felony cases, family law cases, monetary disputes over 50,000, probate, guardianship, mental health, dependency, delinquency, and then also other appeals that may come to them. So of import here as well is noting that in the trial courts, and we talk about our trial courts, we're talking about our county courts and our circuit courts when we talk about our trial courts. And we have some innovations in there to help us resolve disputes. We hope it makes us more efficient in getting cases through the system. And we have alternative dispute resolution that offers arbitration, mediation, and also recently elder caring and parenting coordination. We also have something you all may be familiar with, problem-solving courts. We have drug courts, mental health courts, early childhood courts, and veterans courts. Again, trying to properly put people in the right category so that we can provide services or provide them proper judicial equities, and then move the cases as well. We also have DIY Florida, which helps self-represented litigants. All right, so we'll jump into our district courts of appeal. You all may be familiar, as of January 1 of this year, we now have six. We had five, now we have six district courts of appeal. There are 71 judges in our district courts. They are also have a chief judge, a marshal, and a clerk who help them run the courthouse in those areas. We also have, what matters do they hear? Of course, appeal matters, right? Not directly appealable to the Supreme Court or the Circuit Court. Administrative appeals provided by law, and then certified questions from county court. Last but not least, we have our Supreme Court. We have seven justices, and we have one from each represented district court, and then one at-large member. That makes us have seven. We have a clerk and a marshal that also help run the Supreme Court. And then, of course, they hear many cases, as you will see here, death penalty cases, DCA decisions, bond, public utility cases, advisory opinions, and then other matters at the court's discretion. So how do we make this all work? Well, the state court system is administered by the chief judge and the Supreme Court, and that is pursuant to the Constitution. And then how do they make it work? Of course, we need support and help with that. So we have councils, commissions, steering committees, work groups, and other committees. There's a lot of those that we have to work with. And what they do is they help advise the court, make recommendations so that they can really delve into issues that need to be addressed. You may have friends that serve on a work group or a steering committee. And again, those are the ones that work with finding more information, advising the court. We also have our commissions, which some of you may be familiar with, make the recommendations for our LBR, Trial Court Budget Commission, and our DCA Budget Commission, make recommendations to the Supreme Court for what we need financially, and then we put it in our request to the legislature. And you may be wondering, who is this lady up here talking to you today? Well, I'm the Office of State Courts Administrator, and we also help the Supreme Court with running the entire system. So we provide statewide judicial operations. We provide technical support to our DCAs and to our circuit and county courts as necessary. We also do communications, court education, court committee. We staff all those committee commissions and work groups. We help staff them and do some of the research. We provide statistical information. And then we also do intergovernmental relations. So now we'll get into our neat little pie graphs here. What do we look at? We look at our county courts. What filings do we have? The county court filings are 2.5 million in 21-22. You'll notice the large portion of that is civil traffic infractions at about 52.7. Takes up a lot of time and resources to handle those civil trial infractions. We've also seen an uptick in our filings for county court, in that recently we have increased what they're able to hear. They hear those monetary up to $50,000 that they weren't hearing before. And as you will also see, the next big one is anything civil at about 30%. What about our circuit courts? About 700,000 cases were filed in 21-22. And again, a little bit more, not equal, but a little more proportional here. But family court takes up a large portion there at 34.8. You can imagine family court's a very busy court, and the circuits are the ones that hear those cases. Again, we have civil, probate, and adult criminal. And you'll see the adult criminal is only at 21.2. So a lot of time spent there, but not as great as probate. Or family court, we've seen a slight uptick in our probate cases recently, and so that's increased from years past. DCA provides us a little more colorful pie graph because they hear a few more, they have more things that take up their time, but in little pieces. The largest, of course, as you will notice there, is the 30.2, and that is going to be the criminal cases. Right behind it is the 25.9 with the civil cases that they hear. And again, Supreme Court. We have large chunks right there at 39 and 38, so an equal amount of time. They do have those offshoots that they take up time and spend a lot of time on, but the 39 and 38 are the discretionary review cases and original writs for petition. Again, these are stats from 21, 22, but probably seeing close to the same as we continue. We will continue watching for all these to increase. We do collect data for that. We try to get information on the filing, so then filing to disposition, those types of things to help us say, are we doing a good job? Do we need more resources? And those are things that we collect and gather. So what do we look like in comparison to the big Florida budget? You'll see that little tiny sliver, that yellow, the judiciary is 0.6% of the entire budget. That's a good thing, right? We're a very tiny piece. But we really need that because we try to remain lean and try to do a good job with limited resources. But again, very small portion and sliver of the entire budget. What does that look like for the state court systems? If you'll see, 82.3 takes up our trial courts. That is a huge portion of our daily operations, of what we do. They are just very busy and take up a lot of the resources and appropriations. The other appropriations, of course, go to Supreme Court, DCA, OSCA's in there as well, and a little tiny sliver for Judicial Qualifications Commission, which hear the complaints against judges in this state. So what are we facing right now? What are the current concerns that we'll be watching over the year? The first one that you'll probably continue to hear throughout session is what's going on in the workforce. Just like everybody else, we are struggling with recruitment and retention. We're watching what's going on with that. How is our workforce changing? What are we facing? We'll also keep watching our county court jurisdiction. As I mentioned, it went up this year to monetary amounts over $50,000. So we'll keep watching that and seeing how that changes the landscape for them. We also stood up the 6DCA. You all might have heard a presentation this week on that. We stood that up January 1, and so we'll keep making sure that everything runs smoothly with them. Just as a fun fact, we had, as of the 10th of January, it was opened up on the 1st. As the 10th, they already had 30 new filings in the 6th, and we migrated about 1,600 cases over to the 6DCA in the beginning of the year. The next thing we're kind of very aware of is self-represented litigants. Again, access to justice, and then making sure with self-represented litigants, they don't have attorneys, so sometimes they take up a little more time in the courtroom. It's a little more labor-intensive on the front end sometimes, but we're trying to make sure that we are providing those resources and noting what it takes to help get those self-represented litigants through the system. And then last but not least, we are watching court technology. In the last 3 years, we've seen an uptick. Of course, we've done more Zoom hearings. We have to have more technological resources for that. But we still do remote proceedings, which seem to be pretty favorable with litigants and also attorneys. It makes things go a little faster. They can, you know, have a hearing and then turn around and have another hearing. They're not in their car driving for those. And we want to continue to provide that for them as a resource, and we want to make sure that we are providing what we can and making sure that we have up-to-date technology. And Mr. Chairman, that is done, and I'll take any questions that you have.
Thank you, Ms. Sackett, and you did a wonderful job with your presentation. We asked for Court System 101, and you did a great job. I learned a few things that I didn't know. Hopefully the subcommittee did as well. Do we have any questions at this time for Ms. Sackett? Representative Soroy, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Can you, and please tell me if this is not in your wheelhouse, but can you speak to the process for the certification or decertification of judicial seats and how that report is generated? I understand it's by the Supreme Court and then is submitted to the legislature. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Ms. Sackett, you're recognized.
Yes, I can speak to that a little bit. Of course, you know, the Supreme Court is mandated to do a certification opinion every year, so that means they have to see what's going on in the judiciary. There is a formula that is developed. And of course, it's a formula that we work with in trying to ascertain how is the best way to find out the number of cases, dispositions to the number of judges, time that it takes to get those through. What else are they doing in the day that, like, other administrative responsibilities? Do they have other obligations? Those kind of things. So there is a formula. There's information gathered, and then it's all plugged into this formula, and then there is a pops out information that says, hey, this number is the magic number that should be able to make this county, circuit, or district operate. And with that, there's a recommendation that goes to the Supreme Court. You're correct. The Supreme Court issues that, and they look at and try to take into any secondary factors that may be accounted for. Like, for example, if there's been a hurricane and you have something that, and the numbers may say, oh, this county court may not need this other, it may be overjudged by one. Well, you wouldn't necessarily want to go in and take that judge away because you know there's going to be a lot more claims coming due to the hurricane. So those are the secondary factors that are taken into consideration, as well as that formula. And then they'll prescribe, and then that's when you get or see the opinion that comes out that mentions, should we decrease? So that would be a decertification, but really we say, should we decrease? Or should we increase and ask for another judge? And so like last year, because the new 6 DCA was being implemented, they needed 7 new judges. So that would have been what had transpired last year. And this year's certification opinion has been published as well.
Representative Soroy, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that response. And am I correct in understanding that the legislature receives that report and can take it or leave it? We can't tinker with it.
Ms. Sackett, you're recognized.
That it's completely up to the legislature to decide if they want to decertify or certify a judgeship. So that is correct. It's a mandated thing that the Supreme Court does, and then you all get to decide, do you want to accept that or reject it?
President Beltran, you recognize.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you for the presentation. I want to, pick up where my colleague, Rep. Soroy, left off in terms of these certifications, and I appreciate your presentation in the sense that one of the first slides shows that we are maybe at 2/3 of the national average and behind some of our colleagues in the South in terms of judges per capita. We're certainly not less litigious than our neighbors or other southern states that you've used as the comparators. In terms of the certification process, obviously the Supreme Court has a formula. I suspect that the formula is not comparing to the national average or per capita. And in terms of us certifying, if we want to put more judges than the Supreme Court is asking for, we need a supermajority to do that, to deviate. If y'all say one circuit court judge in Hillsborough County and want to put 5, I have to go get 80 votes to do, and I got to get supermajority in the Senate as well. So I guess my question is, why doesn't the formula reflect more closely? Because I can attest that as a practitioner, especially in the civil courts, there either aren't enough circuit court judges or there's some other problem. It's hard to get hearing time, hard to get your cases to trial. So what can we do with the formula or to help us help the judiciary to get more resources or to increase the efficiency?
Ms. Sackett, you recognize.
That's a great question, and I will say I'm sure all of our circuit and trial court judges or circuit and county, feel the same way. They do probably feel like they are at max capacity, and if you are a attorney that works in the field, it is hard sometimes to get hearing times. So what we do is every so often, and please forgive me on this, I may misquote this, but every 4 or 5 years, I believe we come in and do what we call a time study. And what we have is we will request that our judges basically tell us what is going on in your day. Basically keep a record as if you were keeping time for a client, so to speak. What's taking up your time? And with that, we also work with the National Center for State Courts. That's where we get our formula. They will take all this information, compile it, and then give case weights to how long a case should take. Because you technically would think that a felony case would take longer than a small claims. So it's weighted over here at this number, whereas a felony is weighted here. So then this is this compromise of time versus how long should it take you to resolve the case. And that's a study that's done every 4 years, and we're in the process of updating that study right now. So we are hopeful that things may change. I can't imagine, like you said, with the national average and us being rather lean, that it might not change, but I would say the weights may change, and just how they divvy up their time may change as well, and gives us more information to better articulate what the need is.
President Minnie, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman, Ranking Member. And thank you so much for this presentation. I think it's been informative for a lot of folks. I've got three questions, Mr. Chairman, if I may, in different buckets. One goes, follows Representative Saroy's question, and then two others. On the issue of certification, are the case numbers that the Supreme Court uses to tell the legislature what you think you need, are those numbers the same as the numbers of the Clerk's Corporation and their caseloads?
Ms. Sackett, you recognize.
You're giving me a loaded question. No. So, of course, that's what we struggle with, because that's what we work with. We work with the numbers in the clerk's system. They report that to, say, OSCA or even the trial court administrator in the circuit. They use those numbers, and then we use those to compute, because that's what we have to use. So yes, we do work with the clerk's office and the numbers that are being reported for the filings. That's where we get those numbers and filings, and we do work with them with those numbers, because that's all we have right now to work with. We're trying to use a unified case reporting system that we've been trying to get off the ground for years, and we're trying to work on that so that we have more accurate data, or so we think we can capture more accurate data.
President Brink Meany, look like you're ready for another question. You're recognized.
Thank you, sir. I think I understood you to say they're the same numbers.
That's
second,
correct.
You're recognized.
Sorry. Yes, sir, that's correct. That's the information and data that we have.
President Meany, you're recognized.
Thank you. On time standards, does the Supreme Court have time standards to get its cases resolved?
Ms. Sackett, you recognize.
Thank you. It's not the same time standards as the trial courts. The trial courts work differently than the appellate courts. So they're all working towards a reduction of a certain number of cases, but it is different than the trial courts.
Recognizing you're a former judge, I'm going to go past my three-question rule in the first hour and a half
well,
of this committee.
I understand so, it's a state house, Manny, not a courthouse.
You're recognized.
On trial courts, is there any particular enforcement mechanism when judges do not maintain the trial court case standards, time standards?
Ms. Sackett, you recognize.
Throwing me hard questions today.
I'm not trying to give you hard questions, and I'm certainly not trying to get antagonistic to the branch or to take up the committee's time. It just seems to me like that's something we need to know. I mean,
sure.
You tell us there are time standards. Mm-hmm. Are they enforced, or is there an enforcement mechanism?
Ms. Sackett, you recognize.
Thank you. Enforcement's a strong word. Of course, like I said, the Supreme Court and the Chief Justice work to administer the administrative side of administering the court system. So enforcement, I would say, no, we're not going to go in and hold a circuit court judge accountable for not meeting those time standards or those time frames for moving those cases. What we do is we try to collect that data. We try to monitor what's going on in the courtrooms, again, with case filings and dispositions, and then we work to congenial meet and talk about those issues. Are we seeing something like cases aren't being moved quick enough? Or so we talk about those, and we encourage our judges to work towards meeting those time standards.
Thank you. And one final.
Oh, my gosh. You're recognized, Representative Meany.
And I, again, appreciate the court, the chair's indulgence. And I would really like to get with committee staff and OSCA staff to get more in depth on some of these questions. It's my understanding the pay structure is like the court structure. The Supreme Court justices make more pay than the Court of Appeals justices. judges who make more pay than the circuit court judges who make more pay than the county court judges. When the court requests, and of course I understand the legislature can modify, but when the court requests a given percent pay increase, is it different for the different levels so that the gap between the levels stays the same, or is it a uniform, 5% or 8% or 10% so that the gap gets bigger?
Ms. Sackett, you recognize.
So there is no...
It's kind of a seventh grade arithmetic question.
I think I passed seventh grade math, but that's why I'm an attorney and not a mathematician or a doctor, so to speak. but what the answer is no, there is no standard deviation between the Supreme Court, Circuit Court, DCAs, or trial courts. There's no standard deviation. And right now, it is exactly as you said, there are variations of how much they are paid, but there is nothing standard that would make them have a certain percentage apart. Of course, recently in the last few years, the Supreme Courts were provided a raise without being asked. They were provided a sum of money. The DCA judges were also provided a 10% raise not too long ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and our trial court judges, you all graciously gave them a 5% raise last year through request. So we haven't asked for the DCA and the Supreme Court, but we have requested increases for our trial court judges. And again, there is no standard deviation between their salaries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll get with staff.
Representative Ovidar is up next. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have, I saw you have information obviously on per person data and how we rank on that and on the current slide. I was wondering if you had any data that is per case as far as how many judges there are per case or, and then a second question on that is if you could talk about if there, has there been any increase or decrease on the civil traffic violations and infractions over the last several years?
Ms. Sackett, you recognize.
Thank you. So I don't have that information with me today about how many cases per judge, but I can clearly get that to you and get that back to you. And then the second question, I believe, was have we seen an increase in civil traffic? So there was a slight decrease in civil traffic. It's just ratcheted back up. It's just, a hot topic all the time. It's just, something that they have to deal with in county courts. But we saw a decrease slightly over the last couple of years, but it has started to come back up. And that's just kind of where we are. So there's not been any significant increase, but there was a slight decrease, and now we're back to where we were.
Representative Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Chairman. And thank you for the brief, educational. And I know as I went through, I don't think there's anybody that would disagree that Florida is a litigious state. And that's on the almost the demand side of the equation, and the supply side is providing justice through the court system. I guess my question goes to your time study model, which I believe you keep getting the same formula that is fundamentally flawed. That are you looking at other states, other models of how they may seek efficiency in the courts as opposed to just using the same data in, data out, coming up with Florida well below the national average? Because, there are sometimes people take pride, maybe too much pride, in doing more with less. And there comes a point where justice delayed is justice denied. And I wonder if we don't have an opportunity to right size our courts. So do you look at other methodologies and models for right sizing our courts with these, and that would produce list of recommendation based on benchmarking from other states? Or is the model you have, and that's what we're going to use no matter what?
Ms. Sackett, you recognize.
Thank you. That's why we work with the National Center for State Courts. So the National Center is the organization or the entity, that compiles all the states' information and data. And then they do that comparison. They work with us on that formula. So they take all those into consideration. And again, that's why we work with that formula every so often, every 4 years or every whatever number of years that is, to make sure that we are using most current data, the proper data, and then work with the National Center so that we do have that comparison.
Representative McFarland, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about problem-solving courts and funding for problem-solving courts. Could you explain for us a little bit how those problem-solving courts are paid for? And I recognize that the problem-solving courts that you had on your slide, perhaps that's the standard. I know that my circuit has several others that they've experimented with, which is appropriate to reflect, you know, your locality. But if you could speak to that, I'd appreciate it.
Ms. Sagan, you're recognized.
Thank you. Well, the problem-solving courts, when we need additional funds, we will, of course, build that into our legislative budget request if we need to. Oftentimes, we get money provided through the legislature for funding of those courts, specific funding. We get that money, and then that is then passed, when we get the appropriation, our trial court budget commission. Again, the trial court budget commission is made up of all the 20 circuits, and they look at where is the money needed. So unless the legislature specifically says, I want this amount of money to go here to this particular problem-solving court, the trial court budget commission would take that information and then divvy up where the needs are. So they would assess all the circuits or the courts that have the problem-solving courts and then make that allocation with the amount of resources that they have. So that is how they would get their funding.
Representative McFarland, you recognize for follow-up.
So if my circuit is coming to me and asking for a special member project to fund a problem-solving court, I would assume that's because this commission has, underfunded them or has not given them what they want for that problem-solving court.
Ms. Sackett, you recognize.
Thank you. It could be that, or it could be that they have a special one. Like you said, these are not all inclusive of what a problem-solving court may be. So they may have a special initiative that they want, and if they get specific money allocated for that, they don't have to be part of that allocation from the trial court budget commission. So they wouldn't have to compete with all the rest of the circuits and all the courts.
Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Sackett, for your presentation. Regarding the time frame for the disposition of the case, do you all take into account the different populations of the circuits to recommend a time frame for a court to handle a case to come from filing to the end of the court? Or is it one uniform time frame for circuit courts to dispose of a case or county courts to dispose of a case?
Ms. Sackett, you recognize.
I hope I answer this correctly, and if I don't, I will definitely get back to you with the right answer. It is we have to go with a standard. So when we're doing these and we are using these calculations and these formulas and working with the National Center, they come up with an average. So that is an average of when the case, how much time a case should take. So they do probably look at that, but is it very specific? The answer would be no, it's an average of how long a particular case should take.
That's it for round one. If no other further questions, Representative Saroy, you're recognized in round two.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to revisit the line of questions that my colleague, Representative Maney, was pursuing. When we look at the chart that illustrates the number of judges per capita compared to other states, and you see Florida at 4.9, I guess my next question is what. And I think this was the point that Representative Maney was getting to. What performance measures or benchmarks or goals or whatever we want to call it exist to make sure that the judge's performance is there, that they're keeping, that there's good time management in place, that caseloads are being met. Can you speak to that at all?
Ms. Sackett, you recognize.
I'll do my best. Of course, you know, there are, like you said, bench guides, tools, best practices, and those are what are in place to help move those cases. You'll remember maybe on the slide, they have a chief judge, And the chief judge in that circuit also is monitoring and looking at what's going on in that circuit. And if they see, maybe like, for example, maybe a judge is not doing what they should do, they're in there managing that along with their trial court administrator to find out what is going on. Why aren't these cases moving? Do we have a problem here? So they are monitoring and managing the situation at the trial court level by the chief judge that's in that one. Again, having those benchmarks, guidelines, and best practices to follow. And I'm sure having meetings with them and talking about where are we lagging or what's going on in, say, you know, I don't know, small claims to try to ascertain the problems.
I have a quick question, Ms. Sackett. I know in my county and counties, practitioners evaluate judges. And there's I think it's a scale of 1 to 5. And I think that's a public ranking, at least in my community. Is that done, to your knowledge, across the state? Or you look like a little perplexed. You may not know about that. So I'm just curious if you know anything about that and you're recognized.
Thank you. You're talking other than merit retention?
Yeah. Yes, correct.
I am not aware. I'm not aware of that. I will definitely look into that and get back to you because I'm sure you're probably, your circuit may not be the only place, but I'm not aware of that otherwise, and it's not a standard.
Thank you. Representative Roth, you're recognized. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I a little bit reluctant to ask this question, but I feel like, Ms. Sackett, you may be the right person, so I don't want to miss the opportunity. I really am struggling on this committee because I'm not a lawyer, and so this is kind of, why is it this is the way things happen in court? My issue is, from a layperson's standpoint, it looks like there are times when, I'll pick one example that's in the news today. Some of the legislation we passed, you know, having to do with parental rights and all that, and you have a judge that, you know, stays at, I think it was the one on the court, on the universities, where they were trying to get the universities to be more clear about what they're teaching, whether it's critical race theory or whatever, and you have a judge stay it and say, you know, it doesn't apply or whatever. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm probably not explaining it very well, but it's just curious to me how that one judge, it seems like one judge anywhere can stop the train from going forward by just declaring that bill's unconstitutional. And so can you explain maybe a little bit the process, or maybe who should I go and ask? Because I don't understand how it seems a little bit arbitrary.
Ms. Sackett, you're recognizing you're the court administrator, so you may not have all the knowledge on why a particular case gets stayed.
Not that case.
Right.
Yeah.
I got you. You're recognized.
Thank you. And I can give you the answer but you may want a more in-depth answer that I may not have. But the answer to that is, again, we have judges in place that hear certain cases. As I noticed the breakdown of jurisdictions, that's whether it's in county court, circuit court, or Supreme or DCA. And what I think you may be referring to is if you have a case and a judge hears it and the judge denies the case, or, you know, says it doesn't grant the petitioner or the respondent what they want, then you have an appeal process. And so that's what the other courts are for. So hopefully there's something there that you may be able to appeal, so it may not be the end of the case. And that may or may not answer your question, but that is what our appeal process is for. Because again, the judge is sitting there doing the best job that they can with education and guidelines and benchmarks and hearing the evidence that's before them to make a decision. And then you still have that appeal process if you feel that that wasn't properly followed or that they missed the law or anything like that. Does that help?
And I would note, Representative Roth, that just like you said, we have an appeal process. There's been a few of our statutes we've passed, or laws we've passed, that have been stayed, that the appellate court has gone the other way and reversed that decision. So that's, to me, why our court system works well.
So maybe the better question...
You recognize Representative Roth?
Yeah, so maybe the better question is, are you the person that I should have a further conversation with?
Ms. Sackett, you recognize?
Thank you. I would say no. That may be something more towards, again, I do help with the administration, and those are everything that helps keep the courts running and doing what we're supposed to. That is a very specific question about law, interpretation of the law, and how that works.
And Representative Roth, I offer Mr. Jones as a resource to you as well. He is voluntary, so he will answer any questions you have. Further questions for Ms. Sackett on this hot bench here? Seeing none. Thank you so much. Appreciate you answering our questions. Great job, and really great job. Thank you. Okay, members. There is no further business on our agenda, so this concludes our agenda for today. Representative Black moves we rise. Unless there's an objection upon the motion of Representative Black, the meeting is adjourned.